Hello, it's Kamal Ahmed here, and I'm here to tell you about Energized, the brand new podcast Intelligence Squared is launching in partnership with Iberdrola. The climate crisis is the most pressing issue of our time. Temperatures are set to rise more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels in the next two decades, an increase that will cause irreversible damage to our planet. But is there still hope? If humans are to blame for climate change, then we must also provide the solutions. And that's where Energized comes in. Join me as I bring together experts and policymakers to delve deep into the key issues at the heart of the global drive towards net zero and the innovations that promise to accelerate the energy transition and transform the way we live. Just search Energized wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you love the Intelligence Squared podcast, you can support the show and help us do what we do by hitting subscribe via Apple Podcasts. And in return, you'll get bonus content, ad-free listening, and early episodes too.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. Coming up on the podcast, how can we use culture, craft, and creativity to address historical injustices of the past and map out the path for a sustainable future? We'll be hearing from a panel of experts discussing it all at the Radical Acts Biennial, an initiative from Harewood House. The Radical Acts Biennial is an exhibition exploring the power of craft to create positive change. It's currently taking place at Harewood House, an 18th century country estate in Yorkshire in the UK. Harewood House has been a charitable trust since 1986, and the house was built between 1759 and 1771 on ground bought by Henry Lascelles, a wealthy plantation and slave owner using money gained from the West's Indian sugar trade. Working with the trust, recent generations of the Lascelles family have been at the forefront of acknowledging Harewood's role in colonialism and are committed to being open and honest about the wealth it derived from the transatlantic slave trade. Harewood House is now seeking to use its platform to encourage conversations about some of the most urgent issues of our time: racial injustice, the climate emergency, and health and well-being. The Trust has been a long-standing advocate for the power of the arts, and the Radical Acts Biennial offers a unique opportunity to connect the dots between art and social change. Today's talk is hosted by the journalist and author of Africa is Not a Country, Dipo Foloyan, and explores how creatives of colour are using their craft to challenge colonial narratives, help heal the wounds of racial injustice, and transform our relationship with the environment. Let's hear from Dipo now.
Good evening. This event, Reclaiming the Earth, produced in partnership with Intelligence Squared, will be unpacking questions such as, what stories do the objects we make tell us about ourselves? What impact has colonialism had on the relationship between people of color and the natural world? And what role does craft play in our communities? Now, we're here in these beautiful surroundings with three brilliant speakers to explore these expansive themes. And it's my absolute privilege to introduce them to you now. We have Claire Rattanen, who is an organic food grower and writer based in East Sussex. Her latest book is Unearthed, On Race and Roots and How the Soil Taught Me I Belong, was released this month by Chatto & Windus. So it's very much hot off the press. We have Lagaya Salazar, an independent curator with an interdisciplinary practice focused on the intersection of design, fashion, art, and graphics. She recently curated Craft Council's Gaining Ground exhibition and is completing a Stanley Picker Research Fellowship on Tropical Futures. And finally, Spandau Gopal, creative director of Tipua, a product design studio based in Bangalore and London. She grew up in India and moved to London to study fine art at Central St. Martin's, before stepping out to launch her own business. Can we all please welcome our panel? And now we can begin. And so the first question I'm going to ask is for all three speakers. And it is, why is craft a political subject? And I think we will start with Spendon.
Hi, everyone. It's very nice to be here. So I run a product design studio called Teapoy that I set up maybe about 7 years ago. So I guess, for me, this is a very relevant question because obviously I work in two very different contexts of being here in London and then also having set up crafts-based workshop in Bangalore, which is actually in an industrial area of the city. So I think for me, I definitely tell a very different story of how, what the crafted object can be and the context in which it's made. And when you think about a maker in the kind of Western sense versus, you know, a craftsperson in India, they're two very, very different things. And in India, we have, obviously, we have the caste system. And, you know, you're born into a kind of identity, caste identity, and then that's kind of entrenched with, you know, your occupation. So, for example, you're born into being, you know, a family of potters, for example. And then very much it's trying to create a life by escaping your reality, which is sometimes a very hard one, you know. And, you know, so I often come against this problem of, you know, things like, you know, conservation and, you know, this idea of like, should we, how do we save this craft? You know, how do we kind of make sure it's the same and it never changes, you know, which is mainly, I think, a problem we have because we impose our own nostalgia and a kind of imagination around a certain time and place. And I think those things most often don't exist. So I think, you know, for me, I feel like I address this a lot in my work, where I think it's a very fine balance about thinking about how a craft can evolve so the person making feels like he's consciously there, you know, they're making or kind of honing his craft for a reason, as opposed to being kind of bonded to it for life and not being able to leave his occupation. So I think that, for me, that's where it becomes political, working with craft in an Indian context.
Without the same question.
Very, very difficult question, but also I think a very easy question to answer. I think craft in the context of what I've been working on, I should say I'm not a craft curator at all. I'm a design curator mostly, but I did an exhibition for the Crafts Council on an initiative by the British Council, which was called Crafting Futures, and is very much in the vein of preserving craft traditions in various places around the world. And the difficulties that arise from trying to preserve it in a way that is maybe what was remembered by archives, etc., and museums. So I hear your what you mean about the difficulty between what craft means here and what craft means in maybe the global south. And I guess craft here, in a kind of more Western global north context, can be an act of resistance in the sense that it resists the pace of late capitalism. It takes time. It is something that is perhaps something that we don't value as much, but if you take time to do it, it means that you're resisting, other ways of consuming. I've done a lot of shows on fashion, for example, which is obviously the exact opposite, but also very much in engaged with craft practices. So I think in its most simple form, it's an act of resistance in the context of the global north. But in the context of the global south, it is something totally different, but also political in other ways, because it has been affected by political acts over centuries.
Okay.
It's a great question, and it's a kind of a complicated one for me, because I'm still dancing with the idea that what I do could be considered craft, you know, because I'm a food grower, and most of the time that I've been growing food has been it's to feed people, you know. I wasn't doing it in order to have conversations like this, although I'm really glad that these are taking place now. But I do think that the act of growing food is inherently political, especially when it's done in spaces where it is not necessarily welcome, or it's not necessarily seen in a kind of ordinary sense. And to contextualize that, what I mean is, when I started growing, I was growing in cities, and I was growing in these kind of small, somewhat implausible spaces. And there was something inherently radical about, and inherently political about, growing food into land which would otherwise have been co-opted by people who wanted to, you know, build houses on these spaces and you know, co-opt it into wealth accumulation effectively. And so I think there is something radical about doing something that is so invisibilized and is so denigrated in a kind of social sense. You know, we don't uphold our food producers as I think we ought to. And so to kind of centralize that as something worthwhile and worthy of reverence, I think is an incredible thing to do, because it's something that socially it doesn't happen. We don't think often about where our food comes from, and we don't necessarily engage in interrogations of like what it takes to bring the food to our table. And so, yeah, I think to even just learn what it takes to grow our food and then re-embed ourselves in an understanding of what it takes to sustain us is something that is inherently political.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's stick with that idea, Claire, about sort of land and history.
Yeah.
You look around us and we're in this incredible space that has a very deep colonial history. You know, Henry LaSalle's and then his son Edwin were both plantation and slave owners. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, this space is linked to both exploitation of people as well as land. Mm. And in your book, you talk about... In your book.
Thank you.
You explore your own family's history in Mauritius through your own personal journey, and you know how that led you to where you are today.
Mm.
How did, what sort of started you down the path of growing food?
Mm. Well, I mean, I didn't set out to be on this particular, quite peculiar journey. When I started growing food, I was actually living in New York and working as a documentary producer, and I came across this rooftop farm in right in the middle of the city and was just captivated with what was happening there. And then I just wanted to embed myself further and further into understanding and learning this act of growing food, because it just, I was so taken aback by the fact that I had never really thought about where my food came from, and I didn't know what it took to grow the food that we eat. And so spent a huge amount of time, as much as I possibly could, volunteering there, and that's what brought me back to London. And I kind of set about retraining, and that was in 2015. And so it was very much happening under the kind of what I would describe as dark clouds of the conversations around the EU and around what would then lead up to the Brexit referendum. And so I was doing this thing that I was really like excited about and energized by, you know, it was growing food, but into land that I felt had always been ambivalent about my presence on it. And now these conversations were kind of bringing up these dialogues of unbelonging that I'd carried for such a long time. I mean, I really did carry them all the way to New York and brought them back to London. And so I think that those things happening at the same time, you know, this burgeoning passion for growing food and this kind of, yeah, resurgence of feeling rejected by the land of where I was born, kind of coalesced into an interrogation that I felt I couldn't resist. I felt compelled to figure out what it meant to grow food, what it meant to grow food in a land that I've never felt welcome in, and to grow food as somebody who is the descendant of the enslaved and the indentured, you know. And I think it led to a realization that I really didn't understand or know the history of the island that I came, you know, my family come from, the island of my ancestry. And Mauritius is a very particular and peculiar story in that, you know, if you are to believe the history books, it was uninhabited when it was discovered by Europeans, and has changed hands in a number of ways, and has stolen people and enslaved people and indentured people, and that is what creates that is what makes up the vast majority of the populace to this day. And so it really is an island that is made up of it was magicked into being through colonialism and imperialism and oppression and you know all of these forces. And so for me, you know, having to kind of start investigating that and coming to understand why I didn't know it and why that, you know, that the fact that history had been so erased within my own family was something that I felt led to by the work of food growing. And I find that there's just so much overlap between the stories that brought my ancestors to that island and, you know, and doing the work that I was then sort of re-embedding myself and into doing and reclaiming effectively, that these strands that mirror each other. And so I felt compelled to at least like look at what that meant and I'll arguably ask myself the question whether I should be growing food at all. Like, was this an act of reclamation or was I returning back to the, you know, the site of the most grotesque of crimes?
Is that a question that you find yourself asking yourself still up until now? You know, should I be doing this at all? You've spoken in the past about how working the land is a very complex thing for you, you know, considering your heritage and considering, you know, the fact that, you know, enslavement and indentured slavery is there in your family's past. Mm. You know, how do you reckon with that every day?
Growing food is a very active process and it's a very active act. And so it's something that is, you know, you are in an ongoing cycle of cultivation, aren't you? And so it is something that I dance with regularly. But I think I have come to a point, and it is reflected in my book, that this was the... He's doing a really great job of promoting my book. Thank you very much. You know, we existed as stewards of the land before we were stolen and moved, and our identities were erased, and we were, you know, we existed as people who grew food in dignity, and grew food in community, and took care of each other through the food, through the plants that we grew for one another, and we understood the land, and that sense of disconnection that I had for the longest time is not my heritage. My heritage is something much more profound than that, and so I think through growing food, I've found a sense of reclamation that I think has integrity and is very true, but it is something that I do cultivate and I have to grow, because it can disappear and it can, you know, it's tricky. It's whatever this movement is. Yeah. It's tricky. And so, you know, in the research part of writing the book, you know, I was trying to find these kind of hidden histories and, you know, looking into Mauritian history, which is actually really hard to find. There's not a lot of it. And most of it is incredibly painful. And so there were times, even just during the writing of the book, where I was, you know, I was quite deep into my food growing practice at that point, where I did pull back and really question it. So I do think it's one of those things that I will always dance with. But I do believe that it is a reclamation to step into that role, to step into the role of land steward. Yeah.
And you think more and more, as the industry becomes more diverse, you know, do you think that conversation will become broader, or do you think on an individual level, it'll be easier for people to have?
That's a good question. I mean, I wish I knew. I mean, I can definitely see there's a lot of movement within the kind of horticulture and agriculture sectors to interrogate the histories that created our horticultural and agricultural landscapes and to be in dialogue with what that means in an ongoing way. I mean, it will invariably lead you to questions about land justice and land, you know, distribution, and who gets to work the land, who gets to own land, or who gets to have a say about what that land is used for. So I do think those conversations are happening, but, you know, we are sitting in the context of somewhere that is like incredibly opulent and enormous amounts of land here, and I'm not sure whether there's any plans to start redistributing that, so there's lots of market gardens here or whatever somebody would want to use that land for. So I do think there's a huge way to go before we can actually look at how the, you know, long-standing injustices can be addressed, and I think that's what needs to happen in order for it to be more equitable landscape.
Lagai, let me bring you in here. The Craft Council's Gaining Ground exhibition explored craft as a form of kind of living knowledge. What theme sort of came out of that exhibition for you?
Well, I think the themes I drew out of what were originally about 100 projects, and 9 projects were then in the exhibition, were really about this idea of... There was a lot of overlapping themes, but the ideas of ethics and IP when it comes to craft practices, especially in the Global South, Then there's definitely the kind of disruption of colonialism and capitalism that happened in a lot of places that is being, you know, trying to be addressed through some of these projects. And the role of kind of, I guess, females in craft practice. So those are the kind of the main themes that came through there. And it's quite broad spectrum of practices that were shown in this exhibition, from kind of earth building, lime stabilizing earth to make buildings more resistant to, or earth build buildings more resistant to climate change or more storms, to hand-woven textiles in the Philippines. So it was a very broad spectrum of craft practices, but I think what was very clear is the idea of craft as a means to make a living, but also what that means to showcase that in a way. So a lot of the projects were archiving and library projects that were online, so they're still grappling with how to show that online without giving everything away. So there's a lot of very complicated subject areas that came through.
And a lot of, I think your work in the past has shed a light on a lot of the sort of the craft traditions that have been lost to colonialism. Mm. Can you give us an example of one?
There's so many, but yeah, I guess there's two main aspects in the exhibition, in the sense that there are practices that have lost or have been disrupted by capitalism. For example, the weaving practices in the north of the Philippines, which went from being small looms that you have in your house to big looms, and within that, losing those small looms, you lose the patterns that are inherent in it. So, and then the looms were then archived and acquired by lots of museums across the globe, so they weren't accessible anymore. But what was also, it was also problematic about the kind of scaling up of that practice was that at the same time there was a change in crop. So rice was previously farmed, now it was corn and tobacco. So they lost a lot of the natural dyes that were present in the kind of rice growing process. So there's multiple layers of disruption that happened over the course of a couple of hundreds of years. And now it's so hard to even get cotton, because all the cotton gets exported to China. So there's so many layers of disruption that happened that you kind of, as to your point, it's like, how do you even return to something that was, the past, or that's the ideal craft practice? Or is it more useful to try and look at adapting it and finding new ways of making, in a way? So,
in that attempt to try and find new ways, do you find that people are trying to reconnect to those old traditions? Or is it more of a, let's just look to the future and see what we can do?
I think it's a lot of, like, let's try and survive in most places. I think a lot of the initiatives that were shown in the exhibition are threatened by political change. Nicaragua, for example, that was the earth building project. They closed the charity, the NGO, because no NGOs can operate anymore. So there's a lot of, it's really about survival in many places. So it's not really about looking for innovation. It's more about trying to find a way of making it work.
And what impact do you think kind of bringing these stories to light and having people kind of understand, what has happened, how can that have an impact on these, in these area communities, or can they?
I think it's very complicated, because I think the funding comes in dribs and drabs, honestly, and I think it never is a continuous stream of like investment and training and building of businesses. It comes and then it's gone again, or very often it's residency projects where people come and like learn or teach each other, and then it's only for 6 months and then they're gone again.
So sort of sustainability and the idea.
Well, there's no continuity, right? So, and it's very hard to build that continuity. So I am in two minds about it. There's a couple of projects that were funded that are more like, I guess, like library project, and that were initiated by some of the groups themselves, where I feel like maybe the kind of visibility will bring some sort of, awareness of the situation at least. But it is a very complicated trajectory.
And then sort of after, what comes after sort of survival mode, if things, you know, do improve, then are these communities better able to then return to these practices and then tell, you know, better stories of their traditions or?
Well, and often I think that I should tell the story of when this particular tribe in northern Philippines came to see some of the textiles that had been archived in a local museum, and they were horrified by the fact that they were not living pieces of fabric anymore. Mm. And quite often those fabrics were also used for funeral practices. So the museum in its own right and archives in their own right are very complicated places for craft practices, I think, generally speaking. So. I don't know. I don't know where the future is for so many different types of projects, because they're so locally specific, and the complications of socioeconomic and political environments are very different. So some of them will continue, and some of them might never reconnect.
Yeah. Svendana, let me bring you in here, because you launched your brand with an anti-nostalgia mission. I've heard rumors that there's more to Indian design than just sticking elephants on things, and that sort of Indian culture is far broader than yoga. Tell me more about that.
I just felt agitated. Yeah, obviously this kind of stuff agitated me, which is what propelled me to start Teapoy, really. Because I just think that there is this, the reason I occupy this anti-nostalgia position is because I don't think there's, you know, you've mentioned the word innovation, and I think with innovation comes value. So I feel like if something is kind of entrenched in nostalgia, which a lot of brands tap into, you know, there's lots of Indian brands tapping into nostalgia of like craft traditions that are being lost, you know. So there is this idea of like, let's conserve, let's save, let's preserve, you know. And which is why, you know, tourism in India, or even, you know, it's this idea of escapism to being or going elsewhere. But like, so for me, that's, you know, I was just a bit bored, you know, that there is much more to talk about. Or when are we going to stop talking about this? You know, it's just, you know, how are we adding value to what we're doing? And for me particularly, I was just interested in kind of the objects of daily life, or this kind of lived Indianness. And for me, growing up in Bangalore, which is quite a, you know, modern urban city, I just felt when I moved to the UK when I was 18, I just didn't see, I just felt like stuck in a, you know, that had gone back, even though I didn't know where back was, you know. So I just found it very confusing, and I just felt like I wanted to talk about something else, you know. So I remember walking past Muji, and I was like, you know, this, I feel like, you know, what Muji does with Japanese design in terms of like, okay, they're a big corporation, but like they kind of brought a kind of life, like a lifestyle to the high street, which was quite universal in a way. And then they kind of, I feel like Japanese design has its place in the world, which is, you know, it has certain kind of value system. And I just felt that there was something to be said about India's value system and the kind of everyday life, because, you know, we don't have design institutions. We have NID, which is a kind of Nehruvian post-independence project. But then, you know, but we do have kind of people designing in everyday life. You know, I feel like things like frugality and, you know, just finding solutions to everyday problems, the way that objects are, you know, designed and then made. There is no designer, you know, it's just a manufacturer deciding what to change based on the feedback he gets from the auntie who comes into the shop and is like, I don't like this, it's too expensive, you know, and he kind of does another iteration. So there's this process of natural selection and evolution of kind of design in the everyday, which I was like, you know, we should talk about this. So everything from your stainless steel cups and plates and, you know, just like the tiffin, the tiffin carrier, for instance, or like even the terracotta chai coolers, which is, you know, that design system is amazing because essentially it's a, for everyone who doesn't know what that is, it's like when you drink chai on the street in India, there's, you drink it out of these kind of terracotta cups, which are unglazed. So you drink the chai and then after you drink it, you kind of smash the cup on the floor, and then that clay is then recycled into making cups again. And no one's calling this a sustainable project. You know, it doesn't have like a certification or anything. It's just ingrained into living because that is the best way to design something. That's a very long answer to what you asked me, but yeah, sorry if I was rambling. Yeah.
What are the sort of, you mentioned that you came to the UK and you didn't see yourself represented, your identity represented here. You know, that along with kind of what are the main sort of downsides of having, I guess, Indian communities being treated like a monolith? Apart from that sort of personal frustration, you know, what are the kind of the negative effects of that?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question because I feel that I didn't really feel a connection with the kind of diasporic communities, the British South Asian communities, because they've obviously come to England in a very different way to I have, where I kind of came to, you know, go to university here. So I do feel that you do kind of get, you know, it gets confusing even for yourself because it's like, suddenly I'm, you know, who am I question, because I feel like India is thinking and kind of preoccupied about something else, you know. I feel here it's very much about, there is a, you know, I've lived here for 18 years now, so it's, you know, I understand the conversation around decolonizing, but I feel like in India, the, you know, the British left the imagination like ages ago, like no one remembers, you know, they just left, you know. So it's a completely different conversation, especially now in the current political climate, which is very interesting because, you know, I feel with our, if I can say, I don't know, we think that the Mughals were colonizers more than, you know, the empire. So I just feel that it's very different. So to again get everyone is in the same boat is not the situation. And I think it's, I think it's very problematic also because we're all different.
Would you like to support Intelligence Squared in what we do? Well, just hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts and you can listen to Intelligence Squared ad-free, enjoy exclusive bonus content and get weekly episodes in advance too. Hit subscribe and we'll see you on the other side. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theater, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
And, you know, with your work, is there a difference in the way your products are received in, you know, Bangalore versus, you know, here in the UK?
Yeah. Weirdly, I don't sell anything in India because I just feel that I feel I'm going to be competing with the world's best shops. And, you know, I can't compete with the stainless steel thali plate, you know, that is sold. And there's nothing to add to that design. You know, it's perfect as it is. And I feel that maybe my kind of project is over here where I need to kind of create something new, which is how I connect to diasporic communities in the UK, because in a way that, we're having a conversation because they kind of connect with an idea home through my products, you know. So it's something that I didn't expect would happen, but I think most Indians find my product very expensive, so they just don't.
The guy, just want to come back to you a second on sort of something that you talked about, I think, briefly earlier, and I know you've kind of, it's been part of your research, this idea of who gets the credit for, you know, finding solutions to things like climate change, for example. Mm-hmm. When it's from the West, sort of considered an innovation. When it sort of comes from, you know, what we might call the global South, it's sort of seen as like a return to traditional practices. So you're kind of the West is framed as being, you know, future facing, yeah. You know, while yeah. everyone else is constantly being portrayed as, oh, they're going back to their practices. How are you sort of challenging this in your work, and sort of what have you discovered from your work in this field?
Yeah, it's how I started my research project, Tropical Futures, for the Stanley Picker Gallery, is that discomfort I've been feeling for a long time with the word innovation in the context of sustainable materials that are based on traditional practices quite often. In particular, I probably shouldn't name names, but in particular, one that is to do with pineapple fiber, which is something that's very traditionally used in the Philippines for kind of all sorts of different types of dress, but also other other occasions. But yeah, I guess there's a complication. I think it relates a little bit to what you're calling nostalgia, in that the Global South is always seen as this, you know, place where all the past still exists and is still practiced, but it's never seen as the place where innovation takes place. And I recently met with an artist that I'm working with, and his thesis is around heat, which I think is quite interesting. And this idea that, you know, this, I think he stumbled across the saying, oh, it's too hot for me to think properly. So, and he connects that with the idea of the tropics and anywhere that where it's hot, and, you know, kind of the Global South being a kind of good example of that. His research is mainly in the tropics, but I like that notion, or I dislike that notion of, you know, connecting heat and not being able to think, and, you know, past practices with, you know, not being able to innovate. And, you know, as you say, in India, and it's not just in India, in lots of places, everyday innovations are, you know, just quite commonplace, and they're maybe not celebrated as innovations, but they're just solutions to everyday problems, effectively. So, but yeah, I think that's something that continues to come up in my research, but I also find still quite hard to grapple with, and I'm not quite sure how to unpick it in a way.
Yeah, it's sort of something that seems to come up in a lot of different industries. Some industries will sort of call it the sort of the white savior narrative of coming in and believing that that, you know, that they're the first to do something, and then that is that's innovative, where locally there are no answers anywhere else. Is that clear for you as well? Is that something that you found in sort of the language around food growing, depending on kind of where, you know, maybe a new practice comes in, or traditional, you know, products and ingredients and seasons? Like, do you find that there's a sort of a political language around the way we talk about where our food comes from? And
I mean, when I was listening to both of you speak, the thing that kept coming to my mind was if you broadened it out to look at kind of environmentalism and the way in which we kind of interact with the natural world, there is a lot of conversations that are talking about how colonialism and other forces, capitalism too, have kind of disrupted indigenous practices and indigenous stewarding of land. And you know, if you look back to, you know, settler colonial states particularly, the kind of the disruption that you can pretty much trace the kind of inception of the climate crisis to these disruptions of people being moved off land, or their, you know, indigenous genocide, and then also the kind of either the co-opting of indigenous practices or the erasure of indigenous practices and thus people. And so there is a lot of mirroring in what you've been sharing in the kind of world of, like, what do we do now in the context of the climate, and that does definitely connect to food. And like one of the reasons why I went on the journey that I did to kind of interrogate whether it was right for me to participate in this sector, in this work, was just not seeing anybody who looked like me doing it, and not having anybody who was being upheld as an expert who looked anything other than, honestly, sort of middle-aged to elder white male. And you know, and women feed the world. Like, the vast majority of people who produce the food that feeds us all are women, and they are experts in what they do. And yet there is a cultural appropriation of sorts that sees the, you know, certain practices being kind of taken by and historically too, but you know, kind of taken by practitioners and then kind of resold. I mean, permaculture is a perfect example of that. Permaculture is a kind of and you know, in many ways it's a really useful kind of framework for understanding, you know, for planning a project or understanding how to grow with kind of a sensitivity to the surrounding ecosystem. But if you kind of, it's not an age-old practice that has been handed down over generations. It is, but it's just been taken and rebranded and resold to people as though it is brand new, when it actually is founded in indigenous practices. is. And so it's really interesting to think about nostalgia in that sense, because I think there is a lot of nostalgia in, particularly when you're in kind of regenerative and sustainable kind of agriculture circles. We're talking about like what does it take to heal the land? What does it take for us to be in good relationship with, in right relationship with the land? And like, what will it take for us to address the climate crisis? And a lot of that is looking back to the indigenous practices that have been erased, you know, distorted, disrupted and co-opted, and figuring out how we can actually listen to the people who have been in right relationship this entire time. And so it's interesting to kind of look at that in the kind of framework of innovation, because I would argue that is future thinking. But there is a, you know, time is a construct, isn't it? But it's the Sankofa. It's the, you know, it's the holding in the past and in the future, this idea that those things aren't disconnected. And so I do think we have a lot to learn from indigenous practices, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we're trying to reverse time, you know, because I think there's a lot of conversations about, especially now with the kind of changing agricultural policy in this country, you know, what is it like? People are now, the money is going to be redistributed to those who rewild or plant trees, and that has huge colonial connotations. You know, there's a lot of the languaging around that, and the way that is being conceived is often about moving people off land and creating these kind of idealized landscapes of like pristine nature, as though human beings aren't in relationship to the natural world, aren't in relationship to land, and shouldn't be there. You know, and the only way that we can save us is for us to be taken out of it and it be left to nature. And actually, I would argue that that's actually really problematic, because we are part and parcel of that relationship. And so it's an interesting, there's a slightly more complicated relationship with nostalgia, because there's, for me, I'm definitely somebody who's like, does resist innovation in the agricultural sector, because that often means, you know, chemicals or, you know, tech to the point of being like destructive. And so I'm looking to like kind of agricultural practices that have been practiced for centuries and centuries for the answers. But then whilst simultaneously resisting some of the conceptions that we can, you know, that nostalgia can sometimes introduce into these conversations, introduce into the solutions that we're trying to figure out as a way of addressing the climate crisis, and what will in no distant future be a food crisis eventually.
What a lot of this nostalgia, I think you've all sort of said, is that it sort of introduces this idea of kind of simple narratives, mm-hmm. and singular simple narratives, and that people kind of, that just get passed on from generation to generation. And, you know, through all your works, you've all tried to kind of push back and tell a different story, a more complicated story. What sort of tactics have you used? Like, how difficult do you find that, you know, Spinana, when you try and, you know, explain that there is far more varied palette of designs that can represent India, you know, how do people sort of respond to that? Or you know, or do you try and look past their response and just get on with your own personal work?
Well, you asked me if I employ children, so I say, do you employ children? I mean, it's just all sorts of ridiculous questions, because it's like, you know, I try and not kind of manipulate my photographs on Instagram, for instance. And, you know, if I'm in the workshop in Bangalore, I'm just posting photos on my story. So it's like, you know, people who I work with are more comfortable sitting on the floor and doing something, you know, and it's just natural, you know, and then most likely they'll take their shoes off, you know, and most likely, you know, even though I've given them 50,000 set pairs of gloves and goggles, they will never wear them ever, you know, so it's just, but then I just tell it like it is, you know, because it's like, why should I, you know, what do I have to hide? So those conversations become quite interesting on Instagram, right? Because then there's a kind of now community policing of like, you know, how much does this person get paid, you know? But you're just asking that from someone so removed from a kind of context that you feel that you have the authority to ask that question without actually knowing anything about how I work or who I employ, you know, or what their families are like, or like where their kids go to school, or like any of this stuff, you know. So I just, sometimes my regular working day is like literally like doling out sums of cash, you know, to like people I work with because someone has to pay off a bank loans, someone's relative has passed away, someone's in hospital, you know, someone's like, so sometimes I find it really hard to translate any of that, you know, and so I just don't say anything, you know, I just leave it. And then on the other hand, on the other side, it's like a customer's being like, where's my order, which is fine. But sometimes I just find it hard to navigate the two contexts because they're so vastly different, you know. But what was your question?
you did answer it.
Yeah.
It was more just kind of like, how do you handle, you know, pushing back against these simple narratives? And,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
I'll open up to, you know,
yes.
the rest of the panel.
Yeah, so I guess the reason I was saying all that is, you know, because textiles are a big part of India, you know, and I feel like it's a very established industry. And then, you know, textiles are still produced very much like what you were saying, like on small looms, decentralized, you know, fashion is amazing in India, you know, but I feel like the product story, which is like more like, you know, small, dark, dingy workshops, you know, no one wants to go in there, no one wants to take photos of those places. So in a way, I feel like I've just given myself that job of doing that. And they really are in stark contrast to like beautiful textile stories of like block prints and Kutch and like indigo dyed fabric and people working in very idyllic villages. So I guess the way I'm resisting that narrative is being like, you know, there are makers, these are craftspeople I work with, except that we are working in a city and this is what the city looks like. This is what a factory looks like. This is what an industrial area looks like. You know, this is what a scrap metal workshop looks like. So it's like the images are very different. You know, they're almost the opposite of what you think a crafted object is. Yeah.
Before I turn to the audience, Claire, do you have any kind of tips, tricks, and sort of pushing back against these?
My medium is an exhibition, right? So
yeah.
it's not images as such. But I guess what I did in gaining ground is to try and disrupt. What's interesting about the Crafts Council space is that it's a new gallery space and it has a library in it that's very beautiful and like very well designed. And what I wanted to do is create a space that isn't like a gallery space in the sense that it feels more comfortable, it feels less like intimidating. And I think that's something that I've been fighting all my career is to try and make places feel more accessible. And with Gaining Ground, what I did is actually in a central space, it's all matted and you have to take your shoes off to sit down and read the books. So, which kind of creates an informality, which is something that I'm keen on in spaces that are to do with learning, rather than this, you know, as much as I've studied in many grand libraries and I love that, but I think making spaces more familiar, I think is what I'm trying to do.
I suppose, you know, now that kind of my work has moved into writing, I think that by kind of sharing my peculiar story, I think that what I'm just trying to at least open the window to is to say that that narratives are never simple, and we all carry so many complicated narratives that even if we don't necessarily know them, because I can't find my own family's history, at least engaging in the thought experiment of what it could possibly be at least complicates the possibilities, right? And so I think and then I think once you've kind of engaged in that thought experiment, then you can apply that to anything, you know, and that's sort of what I endeavour to do with my writing. But yeah, I think people love simple narratives. I think, you know, when we look about it in the context of the kind of climate crisis or how we should consume or how we should behave, everyone's just looking for it, like, somebody just tell me. And I often get this question, this has come up in a number of different talks, it's like, what does a decolonial garden look like? I'm like, I can't tell you, like, that's not my job to like write a guide for you to, you can grow this, but you can't grow that. It's not that at all. You know, it's about engaging in more complicated conversations about how we, like, the politics of the spaces that we occupy, like, what did it take for it to be this particular way, and what does it mean for us to engage in it in an ongoing fashion, you know? And so yeah, I think my work is to consistently just introduce complication and not necessarily give anyone solutions because there aren't any.
Yeah, not to make people feel comfortable. No. But to understand, I think you mentioned context and complexity are very important in these discussions, and more discussions like this. And now it's your turn. We will take some questions. I think we have a roving mic. So if you just put your hand up and we will find you with a microphone. Who would like to go first?
I'll take the plunge. So thank you very much. That was really fascinating. I'm a paleoclimate scientist. So what that means is I study climate, environmental change that's happened over the past thousands of years, millions of years. And one of the things when I talk to public audiences or students that I think unnerves people the most is the rate of change, of environmental change that we're undergoing right now. And I was interested in some of the themes that you picked up on, because I don't know how to put that in the context of the rate of change that I'm seeing ahead of us, and which we're already seeing. So I wondered if, perhaps to give my thoughts something tangible, the world's been hotter before, the world's been colder before, plants have always grown, coming back to the food theme. But we've never had a rate of change since we've been undergoing agricultural practices. And I don't mean, you know, commercialized agriculture of the 21st, 20th century. I'm talking about the shift from hunter-gatherer to having some control over the environment. So do you think that changes the narrative at all, the tensions between, I think you posed it as Western innovation and non-Western tradition? And I think just some of the themes that you've spoken about. I suppose most directly that would be a question for you, Claire, but actually it's interesting to hear about the rate of environmental change in the context of all of your works.
Can I refer to myself in my last answer in that, like, I'm not sure I have any of those, you know, I'm not sure how to address those things. I mean, I would be lying if I didn't say it didn't keep me up at night, you know, and sometimes, especially like, the practice, the like journey of writing a book is very, you know, kind of engaged and very insular, and you spend a lot of time by yourself in like thought space and a lot of like emotional space. It's like I came shooting out the other side thinking, oh my God, I've just wasted a year and I could have been doing something more like important, you know. The world is changing so rapidly, and like people are living with the very real consequences of the climate crisis in their lives, and I'm just here like noodling on a laptop talking about my feelings. So I mean, it's not like that. It's great. You should read it. but you know, there is that dialogue is very active in within me, I think the reason why I think these conversations are really necessary and why, because there's a conflict there, isn't there? It's like, why would you kind of spend time in conversations about the past or about, you know, about history or about colonialism and imperialism and how that impacts the way in which we move through the world and the way we cultivate the land and the way its land is divvied up or whatever, when, you know, the climate crisis is in our faces, right? But I do really believe that these conversations are necessary so we don't repeat the same mistakes that have basically created this landscape that is crumbling around us, you know, that, like, if we look at monocultural agriculture and we look at like environmental destruction in order to make ways for monoculture, that was pioneered in the plantation economy, right? And I think that the reason why I think the conversations need to have, they do have an eye to the rate of change, is because if we move rapidly, without a sense of context, without a sense of like where did we go wrong before, then we're just doomed to make the same mistakes. Like I said about the kind of rewilding conversation, I'm amazed at how neo-colonial those conversations become, how idealistic, how nostalgic they become, and they don't account for who was pillaged, who was erased, who is not in that vision of the future. And so I don't know if that necessarily answers your question, but I think all of those things are urgent. And I do think that these kind of conversations have a space in the figuring out of what we do next. But I'm genuinely terrified by the rate of change. And like, you know, it isn't something that is far from my mind while I tap away right. Stories, you know. I'm not sure if that's even remotely comforting. I don't know if it's supposed to be. Actually, we shouldn't be comfortable, should we? We should be uncomfortable and trying to figure out what we do next. But the one thing I think we don't do next is just repeat our colonial mistakes.
I don't know whether I can add that much to what Claire just said. I kind of echo a lot of those thoughts that rattle through my brain every day. I come from a country where the rate of typhoons has increased incredibly fast over the last 10 years. So it's very present in my mind and my family's reality. That doesn't mean that what we do isn't necessary also. So I think, in a way, I'm not really adding much to the answer, but it is. Is something that we need to grapple with whilst also being aware that we might not even have the space to do that very soon. So
I would just like to clarify, I didn't mean climate's changing so fast, that's the only thing we should be thinking about. I suppose I meant in the context of nostalgia and, you know, you talked about seeing Western change as innovation, whereas non-Western change as being a return to ancient practices and tradition. So I wondered whether this rate of change that we've never been through before challenges any of that narrative, because it is so uncharted in the way forwards.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think this kind of idea of time becomes very interesting, and I feel like, you know, it's crossed my mind because we make this one product, which is made by, you know, a craftsperson, and he takes a few weeks to make. He hand builds the pot, and then he has to finish it by leveling it and then burnishing it. So it takes a long time, and I try and put that in my newsletter. So we say it takes 6 to 8 weeks, and then we send it by sea because we don't send anything by air. And I feel in a way that's something that I've been thinking about, which is, you know, that's just how long you've got to wait to get something, you know. And I feel like if we reevaluate this kind of Amazon phenomenon that has happened, and like just the way we're on, like kind of constantly scrolling, and, you know, it's just like, you can have something, you order now, and it's just, you know, I just feel like that's something I think we need to be really aware of. You know, go back to the time where things were made for you and you waited 6 months for a piece of furniture and it's made by someone. And I feel like that's where, you know, that's my resistance as a brand, as a maker, but then it's also resistance from the customer, and together we can take on Amazon, you know. But I just feel that if it's then the pressure's on me to then also be shipping as quickly as Amazon, I think that's where the problem is, because you're going to choose a product that gets to you quicker than waiting for something that's made, which is literally completely circular, you know, a single fire, there's no glaze, you know, there's no waste because it gets crushed down, gets, you know, used back into the product. So I just feel that we've got to reevaluate our own needs. And I feel bad because it's always on the customer to decide and make choices of being like, how does this product come apart and how do I recycle it and where do I take it and what do I do? So I definitely think that that's unfair. And I hope that more brands can have more clarity when they sell products, as opposed to what do you do with the product at the end of its life? You know, that should be the first thing that is on the product page.
Hello, thank you, each of you. It's been such a wonderful conversation. It's quite easy to feel hopeless, and I'm interested to ask each of you what gives you hope today.
I think for me it's the people I work with, you know, just I think going to India and just having tea breaks and just hanging out and just gossiping. I don't know. It's like I just feel like you forget that you've also got to have fun, and that it's, you know, all that other stuff is important. You've got to just have joy, and I think just I feel like that gives me hope, because it's like there's just good people in the world, you know, and it'll be fine. It'll be okay. We'll figure it out. Yeah.
I think small acts of care between people, I think, is on an everyday level, is still something that we, you know, we can derive some positivity from. And I think it's very easy to get caught up in the large narratives, the easy narratives as well. So I think everyday life and the space that you create for things like that, and time is something that I guess we need to also derive our positivity from.
I think my answer is going to be really obvious. It's going to be grow something. Grow something. It's miraculous. Yeah. It's like, yeah. It's ancestral. It is humble. It's earthy. It's divine. And it is miraculous. And like, you know, I can't remember if I actually wrote it into the book, but it's like, you could be incredibly lonely, but aloneness is impossible when you really understand how embedded we are in this like incredible web of thriving that you can participate in if you grow something. If you grow just some flowers and some vegetables and watch the life that comes to your doorstep. And I don't know, I think participating in creating thriving, creating life is the antidote to hopelessness. I think we are so bombarded with narratives of destruction and sadness, and there is just something really incredible about watching life arrive and thriving, and seeing yourself as part of that web is really, really important. It's really humanizing, and it can really take you out of a sense of that kind of hyper individualness that I think can be incredibly lonely and really, really devastating. And then I think, we end up feeling like the thing that we need to do is just figure out how perfectly to consume. It's like, create life instead.
I think that's a pretty great place to leave it. We could go on and on for hours and having this really brilliant discussion, but my immense thanks to Claire, Ligaya, and Spandana for a really, really brilliant discussion today. My thanks to Harewood House and Intelligence Square for putting this all together. Visit harewood.org to find out more. Claire has a book out right now. So if you enjoyed what you heard, buy her book. The guy, do you have anything to sell?
No. Nothing to sell, I'm afraid.
Sure. Spandana.
Yeah, to sell. Please go to my website.
She's got a lot to sell. Yeah. So I'm just saying, if you're a real ally, you'll spend a lot of money this evening on some really brilliant products.
You have a book as well.
He does have a book. Yes. He didn't bring a copy, so I could show it. Yeah. But you have a book.
I do. But it's not about me, but yeah.
can you please share with the audience what your book is?
It's called Africa is Not a Country. So should you find it. But yes, thank our panel for what was a really, really great.
If you'd like to support us in providing a home for passionate debate, deep discussion, and answering the big questions that really matter, do consider becoming an Intelligence Squared Premium Podcast subscriber today. For just a small amount each month, you won't just be directly helping us continue to do what we do. You'll also be getting exclusive episodes each month, ad-free listening, and early access to, currently available via Apple Podcasts. You just need to hit the subscribe button. And if you're not an Apple user, don't worry, we're working on something for you too. Thanks for being a listener, supporting Intelligence Squared, and you're just one click away from getting some exclusive extras too.